to another exciting, dare I say, thrilling episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies.
Let's not overpromise.
We're also on Facebook Live, which is something interesting because one of our guests today, Jack Rico from showbizcafe.com, is we're using his account. We tried this experiment once before, so you could see us as well as hear us if you want to go to Facebook Live.
And by the way, if you've never been to Showbiz Cafe, it's delicious.
It's not that type of cafe.
Try the grilled artichoke. It's really, really good.
I am joined as well. I'm Neil Rosen. I'm joined as always by Bill Brigoli.
I have the equipment.
That's true. Right, we won't elaborate on that. And Bill McCuddy.
I have no equipment.
Mrs.
McCuddy
can
confirm.
Watchers on Facebook Live. This is it. Well, first of all, we're going to talk about Ghostbusters. We're going to talk about The Secret Life of Pets. We're going to talk about a movie called Lennon Company, a Woody Harrelson, Liam Hemsworth movie called The Duel. And we're talking about Green Room with Patrick Stewart. That's what we're going to talk about today. This is an after show to a television show that we do in New York. It can be seen on New York One called called Talking Pictures, and nationally on every Time Warner cable system in the
country.
And
a few Charter, and a group called Sunshine in Florida. By the way, we're going to be Spectrum soon, so expect that big, exciting announcement.
So anyway, let's talk Ghostbusters. Okay, so this is a remake or reboot of the original 1984 classic comedy. The twist with this is it's an all-female cast who play the main characters, and it's basically a Saturday Night Live cast. You've got Leslie Jones, you've got
Kate McKinnon,
you've got Kristen Wiig, a Saturday Night Live alum, and you've got Melissa McCarthy, who's been a frequent host on Saturday Night Live. It's amazing that Lorne Michaels, the producer of Saturday Night Live, is not. I dropped the pen. We're on TV, so I could. What the hell? I'm picking up. Where did it go?
Hey, what's going on?
Neil Rosen.
It doesn't look right.
Neil Rosen does all his own stunts.
That's right.
He picked up his own pen.
Wow. So anyway, you know, it's amazing that Lorne Michaels had anything to do with this thing because it's all Saturday Night Live people. Okay, so if you've seen the original Ghostbusters, it follows the same formula. It's four, this time, women who are trying to, they're saviors who try to rid New York City of pesky ghosts. And
it's the same premise of the original Ghostbusters.
Yes,
except
and
with women.
They're trying to give you a fair share of laughs along the way. Now, I thought the movie started out promising. There's this guy, I don't know the actor's name, who's giving a tour of a haunted house, and he's very dead.
That's the guy from Silicon Valley.
He's very funny.
And the jokes are good. I mean, right from the beginning.
Remote control.
Right from the top of the movie, I'm laughing. I mean, the jokes are clever. They're landing. Every joke is landing for me, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be okay.
So I like the beginning, and then Kristen Wiig, who's a professor at a university, had written a paranormal book at one particular time. She's denying that she ever wrote that book because she wants to get tenure. And if the university finds out that she wrote this screwball book talking about the existence of ghosts, she won't get the tenure. And that's kind of interesting. But then once she actually comes on board and joins, Kate McKinnon and Melissa McCarthy and becomes one of the Ghostbusters, and then Leslie Jones joins up. She's an MTA worker who saw a ghost down on the subway. The movie kind of meanders along. There's some jokes that are funny. They hire Chris Hemsworth, and I think he's the funniest thing in the movie.
Yeah. The bimbro.
As kind of like a dim-witted secretary who was just obsessed with his looks and working out.
Definitely against type, yeah.
That's kind of funny. But, you know, the movie completely falls apart for me. With writer-director Paul Feig, who did Bridesmaids, which was great, and Spy, who did great, and the final act, which is the last 40 minutes, when it just becomes not funny, and it's just a overproduced barrage of special effects, no humor whatsoever. They're just blowing up Times Square, which we've seen in many, many movies. And
you know, the real missed opportunity here is that Paul Feig took a movie like Spy and did a send-up of James Bond movies and all kinds of other kinds of...
Yeah, who's that guy who's great in that? The guy's
Jason Statham.
I made the suit.
I sewed on my own arm. I'm not sure that's even possible. Anyway,
well,
look,
that's the joke.
The cool thing he could have done here with Ghostbusters, and see if you agree, is sent up the CGI movies in some way. And I don't even know how you would do that. Instead, he cops out and does what the other Ghostbusters movies did, which is just rely on a bunch of CGI at the end. And it's just way too much because it hasn't done it all the way. Well, for the first 70 or 80 minutes, it's fine.
That green slimy
ectoplasm,
right, looks so bad 30 years later. It looks like something out of like an old, like, Terry
Nickelodeon Tunes morning special.
You know, they actually have problems with the slime. Ivan Reitman was giving them notes because he's the executive producer and he did the original, and he didn't like the color of the slime. He was complaining about the color, so they worked it.
Well, you know what's interesting?
Sounds like something Donald Trump would say.
Bill Bergoli, is that all of a sudden in this last 40 minutes of just terrible, just explosions and explosions, and they're all of a sudden in Times Square in 1976. And
where do you get 76, by the way?
Well, I'll tell you why, because I live in New York. Nathan's is there, okay? Uh-huh. That's not there anymore.
It's Howard Johnson's.
That narrows your time machine right to 1976?
You're not letting me finish.
You're very specific about that. Yeah.
Fists of Fury, which is a 1976 movie, is playing on the marquee of the National Theater.
It could be a re-release.
Theater.
It could be one of these IFC movies.
There's a Howard Johnson's.
No, there's a Howard Johnson's. It is Times Square, circa mid-70s.
All right. Neil.
It is Times Square in the 70s, but the problem with this is they don't even give you a line as to why. All of a sudden, they're fighting in the middle of present-day Times Square, you know, with the TKTS booth, which has those cascading stairs.
Right,
and it's
modern-day
Times Square. And then all of a sudden, I'm looking up and I'm going, wait a minute, that Coca-Cola sign, and, you know, is not the Coca-Cola. That's an old Coca-Cola sign.
I think most
era.
People who go see the movie will be having this exact conversation
no,
with
no,
friends
no.
afterwards.
Old Times Square, and so much so that when
no
they...
No one's going to be having this
really
conversation about 1976.
Really, they come back with gray hair when they...
Of a space continuum type
apparently
of...
Apparently, they go through some vortex, and they wind up in Times Square from 40 years ago, and it's never explained.
It is never explained, because I didn't get any kind of a time travel thing.
They're fighting ghosts in present-day Times Square, and then for no reason whatsoever, with not... one word of dialogue, all of a sudden they're in 40-year-ago Times Square.
That should be the biggest problem this movie has. However, we're ignoring our guest, Jack, who's holding
me, right?
The camera.
It didn't bother me. I just thought, hey, it's a retro Times Square.
So before, I'm going to give you my opinion, and I want Jack to chime in. Okay?
Wait, you haven't given your opinion yet?
No, I think that...
We know it's your show, Neil, but come
on. No, it's our show.
Jack happened to have said in the making of the show that you liked the last...
Tell me what you think.
Now he's directing.
Right. So listen, here's what I think ultimately about Ghostbusters. It's not a terrible movie, but it's not a great film. It's not better than Part 1 or Part 2 that Bill Murray and cast it. As a comedy, I think it failed. As a nostalgic remembrance of what the 80s franchise used to be and has that sort of vintage DNA, I think it worked.
But
it allowed...
to see that? Who's going to this movie?
No, but you know what?
I think everybody is going to see it.
One of the things
that
Hollywood is doing right now when it comes to their sequels and their remakes is that they're making sure that there's some sort of DNA lineage to the original franchise. We've seen this with the Star Wars films. We've seen this with many of the remakes. And in this particular one, I felt it had the DNA of the original Ghostbusters.
But the best reboots do something clever. And this doesn't have anything cleverer.
What did you think, Bill Bergoli, of this movie?
Welcome to sitting around trying to get a word in edgewise.
Right. Talk as long as you want.
Take
the stage.
Watch out. Did you guys notice the Harold Ramis bust in the movie?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Ah, well... If you showed up earlier,
I didn't stay long enough for what I understood was a Sigourney Weaver cameo.
Yeah, that's the best part of the movie, the cameos. I enjoyed seeing...
Bill Murray was wasted, in my opinion.
Rick Moranis was not there, so if you're hoping for me, Rick Moranis...
But Ernie Hudson shows up, shows up, and Dan Aykroyd shows up.
And the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man shows up.
And they don't play the old characters. They're completely different characters that they play. I mean, Dan Aykroyd's a cab driver, you know, but...
McCuddy disliked Bill Murray's character in this one.
Yeah, I thought it was a complete waste. And this is the guy who didn't want to make a third Ghostbusters because he didn't like any of the scripts, and he said yes to this and probably a big paycheck.
I want Bergoli's opinion on this movie.
If you've seen it, the original, it's kind of fun. It's a, as Jack said, it's a nice little nudge. It's kind of like Star Wars, like the most recent Star Wars. Hey, this stuff
they
you
give
remember.
An homage,
yeah,
right?
They do know an homage. It's fine. I think it could have used another pass through the joke machine script-wise. But my favorite character was Kate McKinnon.
The female Venkman.
Yeah, right? The female Venkman. Unfortunately, there was a scene where she's watching somebody almost get slimed and devoured by the very first ghost that they see, the female ghost. Her only reaction that they give her is to chew on a can of Pringles. And they look like, oh, instead of a joke,
that
we get product placement.
Funny.
Right, right.
Thank you. So listen,
you had a chance to sit down with Melissa McCarthy. What did you guys talk about?
Well, of course, we talked about it being 30 years since the original. And she said, well, it's time for a reboot.
It's been long enough where there are all these people that don't know it. It wasn't quite a part of their lives. So to get to be able to do this and reintroduce it, and if they see this, and you know they're going to go back and see the original two, but it's like a perfect storm.
And then Melissa talked about working with Paul Feig.
I let Paul get about halfway through the sentence before I say, sure. Now, what is it? What do you want to do? I don't really need to hear what it is or who's in it or what I'll be doing. I've offered. I've said, if you need me to do like a one act in your backyard, I'm game.
Well, of course, the most famous thing they did for me, for my money, is Spy. Everyone says Bridesmaids, and of course, that's where they probably met. But Spy to me is like the definitive send up.
Well, you know, I liked it for a while, you know, and then it just kind of ran out of gas for me. I mean, how do you think they're going to make? They want to make.
76% on Rotten Tomatoes. We had some people hating it, but we had like Time Magazine and the New York Times saying that they enjoyed the ride. And I have to agree. I think as much as I didn't care for all the CGI at the end, enough laughs in it.
But that's what the Ghostbusters movies are about. It's about the CGI.
More than that.
It's about
too much of that.
Look, I happen to think that the last half, the third act of this movie was where the entertainment value was.
Not for me.
Because, and I'll challenge you here on this, Neil, it's because when you think about the humor in the first and the second act, none of those jokes really felt like great. I can't use the word great on any of those jokes. And I said, well, where is the entertainment value coming in? And that's where the third act comes in, and I was pleased.
Right. Well, to me, okay, look, if you want to have a real deep discussion on this, I think that a problem with movie making, a lot of movie making today, as opposed to in the days when studio heads ran movies in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, was there was more attention back then paid to scripts. And today there's an over-reliance on special effects that shortchanges screenplays. And I think it's very lazy, although basically now do what you can't do in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s is anything that you could imagine in your mind, you could actually with computer technology do that on the screen. But to me, if there's not a captivating, you know, story, I've seen Times Square, as I said before, blow up in tons of movies. So to see them, you know, using those Ghostbuster guns and pointing them at ghosts in the middle of Times Square and in the process blowing up, you know, the neon signs and the marquees on the theaters. Okay, that might be fun for like 2-3 minutes, but 40 minutes of that shit? I mean, I'm just like, really? It's just, I'm bored. I don't care.
And it wasn't clever. I mean, the problem is, what was interesting about the first one, right, Bergoglio? Right. He's going to ask you, but let me just finish my sentence. The first one was the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man was like a surprise that he had blown up and was coming down the street.
Yeah,
that was clever, funny. You were like, oh my God. And even the Ghostbusters are like, oh no, it's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Guy. Right. There's nothing on that level here, but I still think audiences are going to show up. I think it's going to make tons of money. And I think most people will find it entertaining and passable, especially since they thought they were going to hate it since it was a redo with women in it. I will say, The Hollywood Reporter did a story this week about how
it's missing
a big feminism push. Like they
actually
put women,
Karen James, our colleague, wrote that.
Karen,
what did Karen write?
She said it missed an opportunity to make a feminist statement. And I thought it made the feminist statement just by recasting everybody as women and making the dumb blonde the guy, Chris Hemsworth, instead of normally the chick that's
allow
crazy.
Allow me to interject, okay. Because I think where the lost opportunity was in the marketing. It's a female movie. That is the whole sort of premise behind this sort of a remake, is that we're pushing this because right now we could have a female president in Hillary Clinton. The UK might announce that there's going to be a female prime minister.
We're living in
a world where women are at the forefront, and this was a
but
great
But they want
time
everybody to go.
Sell the
but
movie
they,
and say, not, this
you,
is
You don't just
female.
Sell it to women, though,
you know
because
what?
You don't
there's
make
no
any money if you do that.
There's no reason why women can't attract men to go see movies, especially me. I love to see women on film.
Jack, to me, I didn't care whether there were women in the movie playing the Ghostbusters, or men in the movie playing the Ghostbusters, or robots, or animated people playing the Ghostbusters. I didn't care. To me, it was just, is this going to be an entertaining movie? Right. The gender of the Ghostbusters, I know there was a whole, as you said, brouhaha about it. That was irrelevant to me. It's like, you know...
And I think that's to the film's credit, actually.
I mean, to me, it's like, make me laugh. Make, you know,
I think feminists should be thrilled that they put women in the men's roles and nobody cares.
Saturday Night Live is pretty much dominated and has been dominated lately by a female cast. I mean, you can think of the women that stand out on Saturday Night Live these days. Kate McKinnon, Leslie Jones, who are in this movie. Tina Fey was the head writer on the show. I mean, you had Amy Poehler coming out of there. You know, the Kristen Wiig was in them. You know,
it was directed by a woman for years.
It's a female-driven show, and this is kind of like the alumni and the present cast members mm-hmm. that... To me, gender doesn't matter to me. It was never an issue. It's like, am I going to enjoy the movie? Is it going to make me laugh? And it did for a while, and then it just kind of ran out of gas. All right, is it going to be a franchise movie, Bregoli? You think we're going
to
see?
At least they'll try to get a second one out of it if that opens big this weekend.
Amy Pascal said it's going to go on eternally.
Well, Amy Pascal said it.
Did she say that in an email that you hacked?
Not an email. Maybe somewhere in the Panama Papers, but...
All right, well, we'll see what happens. So that's our take on Ghostbusters. Moving on to The Secret Life of Pets. Well, here's a movie that made an enormous amount of money at the box office, and I saw this last week in a screening, and I got to tell you, I liked Louis C.K. in the movie. I think he's the best thing in the movie. The plot of the movie is the plot of Toy Story, basically, except instead of having toys, it's pets. The Andy leaves in Toy Story and all the toys come to life and then they get lost and they have to find their way back home, and that's the same thing here. There was a new toy, Buzz Lightyear, in Toy Story. There's a new dog that invades Max the dog, voiced by Louis C.K. in Secret Life of Pets. The owner brings a new, I think it's the woman from Kimmy Schmidt, Ellie Kemper,
uh-huh.
brings home a new dog, and Max is leading a very contented life, and then all of a sudden all the other pets talk to each other, and they leave, and there's a dog walker. If you walk around New York, where they walk like 15 dogs at once, and uh-huh. the Max and the new dog, voiced by Eric Stone Street from Modern Family, get lost, and they wind up with this gang of... the head of the gang is voiced by Kevin Hart. He looks like
a bunny.
He looks like a harmless bunny, but he's really a lunatic. And I think Kevin Hart is too over the top here. He's too crazy, and it gets on my nerves after a while. But this group of animals hates the human race and wants all animals to be free, and they want to destroy all humankind.
And by the way, if you go see the movie, it's actually shorter than that description.
Yeah, okay. It is not... it made a lot of money, which means I'm sure we'll be set up for lots of sequels. I didn't think it was original. I don't think it's a terrible movie. I think that kids aged, say, 8 to 12, maybe if you have a savvy kid, maybe 6, 7 years old, but pretty much 8 to 12, will love this movie. But unlike a Pixar movie, which, it works, a lot of them just work on not only a kid's level, but on an adult level. I mean, if you're watching Toy Story 3, which is my favorite, or Up, or Ratatouille.
Ratatouille,
brilliant. Or what's the one with the cricket and the...
So is this like Cars?
The cockroach and the Wall-E.
So is this like Cars?
No. I'm just saying grown-ups will be left out in the cold here, okay? This is strictly for kids. Cars...
And pets. Pets can go and like it.
You're saying... Is it like Cars? No, Cars to me...
Cars being an inferior...
Cars to me is just... I can't stand Cars. Cars is just unwatchable to me. Do you like Cars?
I like the first one.
Did you?
Yeah.
All right. It's apparently John Lasseter. It's a pet project of his, and he likes that. But, it's watchable. It's just not funny. I mean, it's just a very by-the-numbers kind of thing, you know? And as I said, Kevin Hart's annoying. What do you think of it, Jack?
What I was going to say was basically that... Secret Life of Pets, yes, it kind of copies off the template of what Toy Story was, and I thought it did a really good sort of, let's say, copy. But what we're really talking about here is that this is the new era of animation in Hollywood.
Illumination Studios.
This is Illumination Studios. It's not Pixar, but Pixar was the only game in town. And now all of a sudden...
DreamWorks was doing
it. It was never at the level. ever at the level of what Pixar was. It was winning every single Best Picture.
This is nowhere near Pixar.
No, no, no. And what I'm saying is at the end of the day, what we're seeing is we're seeing into the genre this infusion of great creativity, great characters, great story. Well, maybe not. But you know what? It's making a lot of money. Not, Pixar isn't the only one making a lot of money.
What you're saying is there's a new player. And that maybe, they've got to get better. Yes. They're not going to...
This ain't Pixar. I mean, Pixar
No, this is not Pixar.
I can't even begin to tell you how many Pixar movies are my... When I do my top 10 list at the end of the year, they're not just only on the top 10 list. They're my favorite movie of the year where I go like, oh my God, this is just like... You know, I mean, I remember going to Toy Story 3 with my daughter, and we were both, like, crying at the end of the movie. I mean, like, 98%
Well, you got robbed at that screening. 98%
of regular movies don't have an impact on them. And, you know, Jack, you and I were just talking, you mentioned Ratatouille. I mean, what a... I mean...
Masterpiece.
I mean, from a visual standpoint, from a script standpoint...
An emotional standpoint.
And, yeah, it's just amazing, you know? And there's the Pixar movies, the canon... of these movies, every time it would come out, it would be just like, oh my God, Monsters, Inc. is just a hilarious, brilliant movie also.
You know, Ratatouille required some intelligence and some cleverness, and I think what's happened here, I haven't seen this movie, but from what you're describing, I think it's just, they knew they had a killer high concept. You just take your pets and do Toy Story, and that made them lazy, maybe. And it just doesn't have to be as funny because they knew it was going to make tons of money.
The voices is probably the most... fun thing in the movie because there's so many voices in the film that you go, oh my God, who's that? And, oh, is that who that is? You know, like, and you kind of look up because there's a
and
lot
you know
of
you're
famous.
Giving Kevin Hart a hard time, but look at the most money Chris Rock's ever made in a movie is Madagascar's. You know, he always jokes about how made all of his money.
Eddie
and so
Murphy told
I don't give him
they don't pay you anything for doing those.
Eddie Murphy's got.
I got a question, Bill.
Shrek.
Do you own a dog?
Yes, I do.
Do you own a dog, Neil?
My dog just—I had a dog for 14 years and 4 months.
I'm sorry to hear that, man.
The dog just passed away a couple of months ago.
Right,
so
man.
Had a dog.
Bill?
No dog. I used to have a cat.
Okay, so I have a dog. I have a puppy. I have a Maltipoo, and I got to say that the whole concept—the whole
did
concept.
You slow down here.
Did you have a
what?
A Maltipoo. It's a half Maltese, half poodle. They're called designer dogs.
Which
end
is which? Back end is the poodle. Wow.
So,
did you take it to the movie?
No. But you know what? I was thinking that they should do a movie theater where people bring their dogs for a movie like this.
Yeah, that would work.
Nevertheless, they do it with babies. You know, why not?
I saw Cars at a drive-in, so that's sort of the same thing.
Something like that. But what I was going to say is,
that's
I
funny,
think
Neil.
If you,
you should
own
listen
a dog,
to the show. Okay, go.
I think if you own
Cars
a dog,
to drive it. Yeah,
it's too
fun.
Meta. It's too
very
meta.
Very funny, huh?
I think if you own a dog and you see this movie, you're going to get all the nuances that the directors and the producers and the writers meant for us to see, meant for us to laugh. And I think that that's the secret of Secret Life of Pets that Toy Story doesn't have. You don't look at your toy the same way you look at a living animal like a dog and see, oh my God, my dog does the same exact thing, and they copied it into the movie. I think that's the secret of the magic of this film.
Look, I'm not saying it's an awful movie. I'm saying grown-ups, there's not a lot. I think kids will love it, to repeat myself.
I think adults will love it.
No, I don't think adults will love it at all. I think they'll be bored. There's a couple of things that are cute if you have a pet, like, and again, with my dog, you'd go out of the house and you'd forget something and you come back 3 seconds later, you take the garbage out, or you just would go out into the hall for a moment and you'd come back and it's a minute later and it was like you were gone all day. The dog is just like extremely excited to see you and you just left like a few moments ago. And that's
but as a whole, there aren't those jokes that work for adults and kids.
There's a couple of them, but generally speaking, it's just it's a kid's film, you know? It's like, oh, let's escape from the dog catcher, and you know that's a big plot point. And oh, you know, we're gonna hop on the ferry and we can get across back over the river to Manhattan. And you know, it's just it's not great. Louis C.K. to me is the best part of the movie. I really enjoyed listening to his voice.
What does he play?
He's the lead character. He's Max the dog. The whole movie revolves around him.
Yeah, good for him.
So that's good. And there's cameo voices that crop up too, and those are fun. And I forgot the names of the voices, but since we're on Facebook Live. I'm going to look up the names of the voices
on Facebook.
On
Jack, chime in with anybody that did a voice on this movie that you can remember.
Can you remember?
There's so many of them. So Kevin Hart's one of them, definitely. Right?
I said Kevin Hart. So we got Kevin Hart.
Got Kevin Hart.
Okay, Lake Bell is in it. Jenny Slate is in it. Albert Brooks. Albert Brooks is actually tremendous in the movie as a conflicted hawk. He doesn't have any friends. but he really wants to eat the friends. He's kind of like torn. So that,
by
Albert
the way,
Brooks is
a retrospective of his
Dana
early
Carvey's in the movie. Hannibal Buress
Netflix.
Is in the movie. Bobby Moynihan is in the movie. There's a lot of voices in the movie, and you go like, oh, there's Dana. You know, and you hear it, and you go like, oh, there's Dana Carvey doing his old man voice and stuff. But I don't know. I'm not thrilled. Okay, so let's move on. There's a movie called that I really like. It's a Western. They don't make a lot of Westerns these days. And it's called The Duel. And it's with Woody Harrelson, and it's with Liam Hemsworth. And I am tired of telling everybody what movies are about. So, Jack, why don't you tell everybody what this movie is about?
The Duel? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
The Duel is a Western, but it's not as good as the Westerns that have come out this year, like Slow West, Bone Tomahawk, last year's, and The Revenant, which is somewhat of a Western, along
Hateful
with The Hateful Eight with Quentin Tarantino. When you're coming up with that level, that quality, that creativity to the genre of Western, which is not Once Upon a Time.
What this is about?
So what I'll tell everybody is about is I'm setting it up, deal, is that this movie is about a Texas Ranger, played by Liam Hemsworth, who is ordered by the governor to go and find out what's happening in this town of Helena that is run by a preacher played by Woody Harrelson
about
what's going on
100
years ago. About what's happening to the Mexicans that are crossing the town. They're disappeared. Are they dead? Are they alive? Have they been sequestered? And that is the job of Liam Hemsworth. But that's not what the movie's plot ultimately is about. What is mostly about is about the establishment of this hero, the establishment of this villain, and then both of them duking it out at the end. It's like Rocky meets the Dolph Lundgren, and they're going to have one big fight at the end of the movie.
Well, you know that when you start.
Right,
because
you know
there's
it, but
a
it was anticlimactic.
I'm not going to give anything away when I say there's a duel at the beginning between Woody Harrelson and the father of Liam Hemsworth, and little Liam Hemsworth is there and sees it, and you just look in his eyes like, oh, no! And you know there's going to be a duel at the end of the movie. So,
and it didn't even allude to that, because it would have been a revenge film.
In between all of that, Woody Harrelson is acting up a storm in a way that I totally enjoyed. So I recommend this film. I called it one of the worst, best movies of the year, because it's campy and over the top and cool, and I think you'll enjoy it.
I think the movie's great. I did not like Hateful Eight, and Quentin Tarantino is my favorite contemporary director. I think that was a kind of went off the rails.
This script has a Tarantino-esque kind of feel, right?
Movie,
would you admit?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, it's not as funny, but here's the thing: Woody Harrelson is psychotic. This character he's insane, and Woody Harrelson pulls it off. I mean, he's mesmerizing to watch in this. I mean, he's basically this cult leader in this town, and everybody listens to everything that he says. And, you know, and he's initially very friendly to Liam Hemsworth. He makes him a sheriff after knowing him for like a day. And Liam Hemsworth has this Mexican wife who was betrothed. Was that the term they used
betrothed?
In the film?
Betrothed,
yeah. Played by Elise Braga.
Right. And they, you know, he doesn't tell anybody who he is, that he's a Texas Ranger. He goes there. And it's kind of like a cat and mouse game. You know who's great in this?
Very cliche, very cookie cutter.
The guy who plays Woody Harrelson's son, Emery Cohen, who you might remember.
He reminds me of Johnny Depp.
Well, he was
Does anybody agree with me with that?
More Ben Foster to me. But.
He was Saoirse Ronan's love interest in Brooklyn. He was also in the thing with the Pines. What's the name of that?
Beyond the Pines.
Place Beyond the Pines.
Place Beyond the Pines. Yeah.
Right. He's an excellent actor.
He was great in that, I felt.
Yeah, and this more than held my interest, and it's fun for fans of Westerns. Let me ask you something, Carly. Do you like Westerns? Westerns don't really make... people don't run
to
Westerns.
Westerns are interesting. Westerns, you can usually tell without anyone cueing you in, you can usually look at a Western and tell what time period it was made in.
What time period the Western was
the
made?
The Western was made.
Right, like if you're watching...
Like a 60s Western is completely different than a 70s Western.
You can see by the haircuts. The haircuts, yeah. like if you look at an episode of Bonanza, you know, like just like the way the sideburns are and the haircuts, like, and the
right.
Technicolor.
And fast forward to now, and when everybody's got longish hair and everything.
Right,
yeah.
It's like, it's you're right, you could tell, or you could even see, like, other than the black and white aspect of it, if you look at one of those, like, Hopalong Cassidy things, you know, with the big hat and the white hair. Right, it's true, the Westerns... You can tell a decade of Western has been made by the look of the Western.
Can I tell you my friend Bob Summerby's best Bonanza joke? He said, "You're telling me the woman who successfully gave birth to Hoss died giving birth to little Joe.
That's good. That's good.
Little plug, little sidebar there.
Anyway, I disagree with you, Jack. I like the movie. I think if you like Westerns, I think you'll like it. You know, it unfolds slowly, which I liked also. I was with it every step of the way.
It is long. I admit it. Some people who don't like it say it shouldn't be 2 hours.
And it's twisted and kind of bizarre, and there's a lot of surprises.
I think it's a little gem. It's a video-on-demand gem.
I liked it a lot. All right, let's move on.
Jack doesn't agree.
There's a movie which you could tell us about, Bill, called with Reese Ifans, called Lennon Company.
Yeah, this is about a kind of reclusive jackass who is a music producer who had a meltdown a month earlier on an award show and worked with this famous sort of Madonna-esque singer who shows up one day at his house along with his son. His son is a would-be musician as well, has a demo tape he wants him to listen to, and this guy could not be less interested in anyone but himself. I think this is great Reese Ifans movie because he's normally the funny guy like he is in Notting Hill or any of the British comedies where he's the sidekick. In this one, he's a complete prick. And he is from the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie. And I admire that. He's playing against type. And he doesn't take. He has a slight modicum of redemption, but not enough to. At the end, he just wants to be alone the way he was in the beginning. I think this is cool.
With some kid
Well, he goes back and he yells at a kid who's working for him, and then he makes amends by going to the guy's house.
So he's not a complete prick, but he's not a nice guy.
Can I say something about this movie? I really thoroughly enjoyed this movie, Lennon Company. Here's why. Number one, every movie is subjective. I connected a lot with the character. Number one, this is a guy that's lost. He's existentially lost. He doesn't know what's going on. Every dream that he ever had was not only achieved, it was surpassed. And so now he's going, well, what else do I shoot for? What about being a good parent? He's not getting it. His kids come over. And it takes place in upstate. I have a home in upstate. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to be lost. I'm sure you guys have felt at some point what it's like to be lost.
Not for
purpose
goalie.
Of life. Not for goalie, probably.
Never. No.
But
often during this show, yes.
Never in life.
But the journey, yes, true, Bill. The journey was not as deep, but it was touched upon, and that ultimately was like, okay, where are you going with this? And at the end, he became a better person by the end of the movie. So yes, it was not three-dimensional in the terms of the richness of the exploration of the character study of Reese Ifans, but it did enough to intrigue me in the character. His performance was great. I liked the characters. I liked everything about it.
Okay, I liked Reese Ifans. I usually do in anything he's in. This is a different kind of role for him. I bought him as, I could see him, and he's this aging punk rocker. You could see him being this punk rocker 30 years earlier.
Very versatile as an actor.
And now he's very disillusioned with life, and he's a music producer, and he has this protege played by, what's her name, Juno Temple?
Juno mm-hmm. Temple, yeah.
Juno Temple, who's quite
who is in Vinyl.
Although she has something cliched happens to her.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I was disappointed in that.
Cliché.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned
her character was the only thing that didn't really work.
But, you know, I liked it. I didn't really know where it was going. I was following it along. His son comes up with an unexpected visit, and all the son wants him to do is doesn't even want anything from the guy, but just listen to my demo tape, and the guy can't even muster up enough energy to do that. And there's some interesting scenes. He wants the son to smash his cherished Telecaster guitar, and you know, but what ruined this movie for me and almost negated the whole thing is the ending of the movie, because I think a better ending, this movie just kind of ends. It just kind of ends, and I think that you know, a better ending could have made this so much better of a movie and would have given more meaning to the entire proceeding.
I think I said it on the show, you didn't get the ending. You didn't understand the song they were listening to at the end, which I think is very profound, and I think it's not as bad as you say.
Well, my wife and I watched the movie, and at the end of the movie, we both said, when it ended, we were like, are you kidding? That's it? So I liked it up until the end, and I think that other than that cliche Juno Temple thing,
right.
But I think that if they, you know, made a better ending, the whole experience would have been better for me. But I don't hate the movie. I don't love the movie.
Do you recommend it?
I'm going to say I'm mixed on it. I'm going to say that...
Yes or no? He's having a crisis.
If you're a Reese fan, if you're a Reese fan.
Neil Rosen's having a crisis.
We just went in for crisis cam. For those of you listening to this podcast.
Wow, that took a while, Neil. That took a while.
Barely.
Just barely.
I thought.
All right, so it's recommendable. Barely.
How many apples?
I'd go like 2 to 2.5.
Wow, that's good.
That's watchable. That's watchable. Okay.
2 to 2.5.
Shows you how reliable that Apple system is.
All right, so next week, Star Trek. Cafe Society, the new Woody Allen movie, and we'll be joined by Mike Sargent.
All right.
Only Mike Sargent.
Who will not have us live on television. Thank you, Jack Rico.
So, Jack Rico, how many people have been watching us on Facebook Live?
Well, we're getting some comments there. This one in 33 minutes.
Yeah, let's answer some comments.
They all hate you, Neil, because you disagree with Jack, everyone on her
in
his channel.
Account, yeah.
All right, so let's hear some comments.
No, it's basically, hi, Jack. It's in Spanish.
Oh, that's great. Hola.
Hola.
Hola, yeah.
Well, adios. The Facebook Live listeners, thank you all, and we'll thanks for sitting around. Oh, Bill, say your famous line, your signature line you say every week.
Neil, just isn't that funny. It's we watch the bad movies so you don't have
That's
to.
Correct.
There you go.
And thanks for sitting around talking movies with us, and we'll sit around talking movies with you next week.